Labor and Commerce now come to orders, 3:15 on the 25th of January. With us are Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler, myself, Chair Olson, and Representative Aaron. We do have a quorum, barely, to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Today with us we have Becky Holtberg, Commissioner of Administration, and Mike Barnhill, Grand Poobah of Retirement and Benefits. Close enough?
Okay.
I think that's a promotion, don't worry. Becky, please join us. And thank you for coming today.
For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. And with me today, I have the retitled but Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill, also from the Department of Administration. And I'm going to just do a quick overview of the department. If there are any areas you want me to stop and talk a little bit more about, I can. Otherwise, I'll get through. We're a pretty complex department, and we do a lot of different things. So I'm going to try to get through just kind of an overview of what we do fairly quickly. And then Deputy Commissioner Barnhill will be talking in more detail about retirement and benefits issues, including the unfunded pension liability. So with that, I'll get started. We are really a department of departments. In many states, our individual divisions would be departments. So we're very diverse, and we have a variety of different functions. This next slide in your packet is an organization chart that shows you all the divisions and independent agencies underneath the purview of the Department of Administration. And it's organized by services we provide to state agencies, because that's a core function of the department, is to provide business support services to state agencies, and then services to the public. And you can see that we're about evenly divided in those two areas. I would note that we have a number of independent commissions, boards and commissions, as do other agencies. Those include the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, and then while we have it under the under services to state agencies, the Office of Administrative Hearings is an independent body that hears administrative appeals. Quick look at where we are, where we're located in the state. For our core service, for the core services we provide to state agencies, most of those employees and services are in our population, main population centers, Juneau and Anchorage, and to a little bit lesser extent Fairbanks. But when you look at the services we provide to the public, which include the Division of Motor Vehicles, the Office of Public Advocacy, and the Public Defender Agency, we have a statewide presence. Quick facts, we have over 1,100 employees in FY13. A little over 1,000 of those are full-time employees. And our budget this year is about $335 million. A few highlights of our strategic plan. I'm not going to go over this in detail. I want to note our mission, which is based on our core statutory purpose, which is to provide consistent and efficient support services for state agencies. We've also gone through an internal strategic planning process, and out of that, we've developed four department goals. And those are really the areas that we focus on and that we track in terms of our performance. Service excellence, we want to provide excellent customer service, recognizing that our customers don't always have another provider. It's not like we're in competition. However, they still deserve to have an excellent customer experience every time. Spending growth reduction, we, like many in this body, have been concerned about our own rate of growth, so we have made it a goal to reduce our annual rate of spending growth. Effective and efficient delivery of services, we want to implement strategies to achieve operational efficiencies, because that's how we can reduce that rate of spending growth. And then employee development and support, we believe that it is our people who are going to provide that excellent customer service and who are going to provide us the innovations that will help us to effectively and efficiently deliver services, so we need to support our people. One quick slide about what our results are in that area. Our five-year trend of expenditures, I'm happy to tell you, has been growing at a smaller and smaller rate. So we are achieving somewhat our goal of bending down the cost curve. We can see in 2009, we grew at a 5.75% rate of growth. This last year was 2.41%. I'm happy about that. I think we have some challenges, that some of which are outside of our control this year, that perhaps could impact that number next year. I also want to note, and I'll talk about this a little bit later in the presentation, that our core personal services line growth across the state of Alaska since 2006 has been 5.45%. So if you look at, for most agencies, personal services is the biggest component of expenditures, if not one of the biggest. So you're growing, that line is growing at 5.45% annually. So if we're growing at 2.41%, it means we're either finding efficiencies or we're finding other ways to transfer money into that personal services line to compensate for that. So it is, I think, significant to grow that we've been able to bend down that cost curve. Just a few comments on the three core services we provide to the public, and then I'm going to spend the rest of my time here talking about the services we provide to state agencies. The Department of Motor Vehicles is within the Department of Administration. Obviously, customer service is at the forefront of this agency. We have a new division director at the Department of Motor, or I'm sorry, I should say Division of Motor Vehicles. Like I said, it's a department in many other states. We have a new executive director, Whitney Brewster, who is a former executive director, is now the executive director of the Department of Motor Vehicles in Texas. And Amy Erickson just came on board as our new director. There have been a lot of, I think, positive changes made at DMV in the last several years. I think customer service has improved. Can it improve further? Absolutely. It can always improve. And we have a couple of significant IT initiatives going on right now in the division around driver's license and ID card security, and then a knowledge testing system replacement. The knowledge testing system, obviously, is the system you go in and test on when you're getting a license or permit. I'll briefly touch on the Office of Public Advocacy and the Public Defender Agency. The role of the Public Defender Agency, I think, doesn't really require much of an explanation other than to say that upholding the rights of the accused is an important constitutional principle, and they are the first attorney of reference for an indigent public defendant. If they have a conflict with a case, then that defense, that case goes over to the Office of Public Advocacy, which has a couple of purposes. One is to provide counsel in the event that the public defender has a conflict. But they also manage the public guardian program, which helps whenever there are Alaskans adult Alaskans who do not have the capacity to make some decisions for themselves, the state, if there's not a family member, will step in as the public guardian. And then the court-appointed special advocate program, the CASA program, and the guardian ad litem program, which protects the rights of children legal cases. One thing I want to touch on with these two agencies is that we do not anticipate having a supplemental at this time, and I will use that qualifier, at this time, for either the Office of Public Advocacy or the Public Defender Agency. And if indeed we can go the balance of the fiscal year with no supplemental, it would be the first time in the history of the Public Defender Agency that they won't have had a supplemental.
Commissioner, would you like to take questions as you go along or at the end?
Absolutely, as I go along, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, relative to the Public Defender Agency, I find myself sort of amazed that I even asked this because I was a state prosecutor, but they're seeking an increase in their budget. Are you also going to provide or ask for more resources for the PDs? And the reason I say that is the system does tend to work best when that tension is somewhat even and there's an even playing field.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, we're very conscious of that. And we monitor very closely what's happening at the Department of Law with respect to resources for prosecutors. We don't anticipate a supplemental this year because we believe philosophically that the legislature appropriates money and then we need to manage within that authorization. And that's the philosophy we are attempting to employ. However, that does not mean that you will not see an increment in the FY14 budget.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Holper, this might not be the right place to ask a question, but if you could briefly, I'd had some experience with the computer system in DMV for legislation last year. It's not the most up-to-date system, and I don't know if it's going to be, but could you speak generally about the state of the IT resources in your department?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we have a multi-year plan to replace the core DMV system and to add new functionality. And so I'm probably not the best person to tell you the details of that IT plan. I could provide it for you. But it does, we are replacing essentially our core systems and then going to be able in a few years, as this is it's a multi-year project to do that, to add some new functionality that the insurance industry is looking for with real-time records. So that process is going to take some time, but we have the money appropriated and we have a plan to update those systems.
Clarify, and that's not just DMV, that sets for insurance for other things? Or
through the chair, Representative Sadler, the specific new functionality that I was talking about relates to records that we transmit back and forth with the insurance industry regarding accidents, actions on licenses, et cetera. So.
But in department-wide, not just the DMV program, what's the state of your IT resources?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a very good question. We have a couple of answers to it. We have, I would say, three really two significant buckets of IT work going on now, not even counting DMV. We have our core enterprise technology services, which provides core telecommunications, network services, mainframe services, et cetera, for the state as an enterprise. I have a slide on that and on ETS priorities a bit later. We also have the IRIS project, which is a project to replace our legacy accounting and payroll systems that are 20 and 25 years old. I have a slide on that a little bit later. Those are probably, when we talk about IT projects and IT resources, the two most significant things that we have going on. We also have division level activities. The division of DMV is one where we have a pretty significant IT initiative going on within the division. We also have replacement of Workplace Alaska going on right now within the Division of Personnel. That's our online recruitment system. And then DRB, Division of Retirement and Benefits, has a fairly significant IT initiative going on as well. So IT is somewhat decentralized at an application level. So that's why you see divisions working on these specific applications that apply only to their division. But then we have the two really broad areas, ETS and then the IRIS project, which will impact literally every state employee.
Right.
And I'll talk about those.
It sounds like you're on it, so I jumped the gun, so thank you.
Later. So turning to services to state agencies, this is just kind of a fun little graphic to show you what we do. We employ people to perform tasks, and in doing that, we pay them wages. We negotiate labor agreements, we manage their health care, and we have retirement programs for them. We also, these people, like I said, perform tasks. We, through the administrative manual, through the Division of Finance, and through other divisions, have some input and management into the business processes that many of these people are performing, especially on the administrative side. We provide these people who perform tasks for us IT services. We insure them against injury, and we insure the workspaces that they live in through the division of risk, or that they work in through the division of risk management. We buy commodities to support them in their work, like office furniture and supplies, and then we provide them places to work through the leases that we manage in general services. So I'm going to touch briefly on kind of these functional areas, what we do in them, and then what we're doing to manage those costs, because these are costs that we incur and we manage, but ultimately get borne by all state agencies. So personal services. Our personal services line, as I said, increases at about a rate of about 5.45% a year. That's been the historic rate of increase since 2006. Now, the personal services line includes the negotiated cost of living allowance, negotiated and statutory merit increases and pay increments, and increases in the employer-paid health insurance premium, and also, not on this slide, but the retirement contribution that we make on behalf of those employees. Mike will talk a little bit later about the retirement side, and that side is relatively fixed, so it is not the source of the increase in personal services. The source of that increase are these three factors that you see on this slide. You can see on the right, I have just a listing of our breakdown of executive branch employees by bargaining unit, and then at the bottom you can see exempt and partially exempt employees as well. So another important item to note is that agencies typically get money to cover the negotiated cost of living allowances that we bargain and that get put into statute for exempt and partially exempt employees. And they get money to cover the increase in the employer-paid health insurance premium, but they don't get appropriations to cover the negotiated merit increases in pay increments, which for an employee starting at A step, which is typically where employees are hired into the state, they get a 3.5% increase every year till they hit F step. Once they're beyond F step, at G step, they get a 3.75% increase every other year, pretty in perpetuity. So those are significant costs. They're not costs that agencies get money to pay for every year.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, Commissioner Holper, this is a question I've been asked by people in my district, and stated simply, and I hope not crudely, is it possible for the state for state employees not to get raises? Is it possible for our employee costs not to rise? You've touched on that, but can you give me a clear basic statement as to why that is? Is that because of the contracts we negotiated, because of the rules of employment, or quite what?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, primarily, the source primarily, if you go back and you can see the number of bargaining units we have, the primary source of those increases are the negotiated contracts. I can tell you, though, that the merit increase and pay increment system is not something that is typically on the table in a bargaining session. It is just sort of the basic compensation package. That's not to say that it can't be, but in past years it has not been. It is also for exempt and partially exempt employees. It's statutory, and so to make any kind of a change in a labor contract would be necessary to change statute to ensure that all of our employees are under the same pay structure, which is important as an employer. So that's the short answer. We have about three contracts come up a year, and so we're negotiating right now with the general government unit, which is the largest bargaining unit we have. We're also negotiating with the supervisory unit, which is our second largest group, and then with the Confidential Employees Association, which is essentially our HR employees and a few others.
What is the length of those contracts? Is it 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, it's 3 years. And they come up in a cycle like that because just simply for capacity purposes, it takes a lot of manpower to negotiate, and so we have to stagger them. So let's turn to our contribution to active employee health plans. This bar chart shows you the increase in the employer-paid portion of the premium for our active employee health plans. One item to note, we don't cover, all state employees are not covered by the Alaska Care Active Plan. That we fund four union health trusts. And you can see that on the right side. The Group Health and Life Benefits Fund is our basic employee plan. The ASEA Health Trust, the LTC Health Trust, and the PSEA, which purchases third-party insurance, and MMMP, those four we fund, but their unions through a health trust cover their health insurance with that contribution we make. I think the important thing to note on this slide is just that our rate of employer contribution keeps climbing. We pay 100% of the basic premium for a family plan, for our family economy plan, and I would note that we're one of only seven states that pays 100% of that premium for a basic plan. We have, the escalation of these costs is of significant concern to us. We have a number of strategies that we're implementing to try to address the rate of growth of our health care costs. I won't probably get into them in the interest of time today, but I'm happy to talk to you at any time about the things that we're doing to manage those costs. One other item to note about health care that's not in your slide but I'll speak to verbally is I was in front of this committee last year and asked about preventive care for retirees. The retiree plan is a unique animal in that it is covered by the Constitution's diminishment clause. And so its benefits, so it is not like a typical employee health plan or insurance plan where you can change benefits as the insurance market changes, as what is considered a commercial, you know, commercial norm changes, because those benefits are constitutionally protected. So it makes it very difficult because the way that the court is interpreted the diminishment clause is that the dollar value of the retiree contribution is subject to that. So we have an increasingly valuable plan to retirees because we are unable to adjust the deductible and copay over time. And so what used to be about an 80-20 plan is now a 95-5 plan. And the issue that came up last session was that retirees, and we were very conscious of it and already working toward it, is retirees, there are some benefits that are not in the retiree health plan that retirees want. There are dependent coverage to age 26 is one of them because we're not covered by the Affordable Care Act. Preventive care is another, and we don't disagree with them. But I am very hesitant in my capacity as commissioner to add in benefits, to add in costs to a plan that a future commissioner then could not take out without adding an offsetting enhancement. And we have a $4 billion liability related to health care for our retirees, part of the overall $12 billion liability. $4 billion of it is health care. So it would not be responsible just to layer on costs to that plan. So we do have one solution where it's plan changes are possible. They're just typically litigated. So one solution is just to change the plan, add some enhancements, take some things away, see if we could, you know, end up in court. The other solution is to create an optional retiree plan that retirees could elect into. We have done that. We have a draft of that plan now. We're in the process of having our actuary review the draft plan to see if we would have enough retirees elect over into that plan to make it worthwhile. And I'm happy to talk to you if you're interested about what the provisions of that plan would be that would save money and the provisions that would be enhancements.
For the two new members of the committee and the people in the room that weren't here for this discussion last year, what set it off was colorectal screening for retirees as the additional benefit.
So moving on after benefits to business processes, this slide is an overview, a kind of a busy overview, of the Integrated Resource Information System project, which is our replacement of our core accounting and payroll systems. It also is going to add HR and procurement functionality at an enterprise level for the state for the very first time. So I'm, in the interest of time, I probably won't get into details of the project other than to say this is a significant IT initiative for the state as a whole. It's going to ultimately affect every state employee. And change management is a very critical component of this project and one that we're conscious of because it's going to change the way many of our employees, especially in the accounting and the procurement world, do their jobs. Space costs. We manage the spaces, the leased spaces, and some of the state-owned spaces that people work in. Graph shows you the ever-escalating costs associated with leases. There are two components to that cost growth. One is just the regular inflation of when you renegotiate a lease, the price doesn't typically go down, it typically goes up. The other factor is agencies needing more space. So we have very little control over these costs directly because they are typically through RFPs that we have put out in a competitive market and pick the most competitive RFP or most competitive respondent. But what we can do is ensure that we're using the space that we have effectively. And we've just implemented new universal space standards that are modeled on what many private sector organizations have implemented. The square footage per employee will shrink. However, we are also limiting the number of private offices that we have, moving those private offices away from exterior walls so that the space will be much lighter. It will be much more, we have features what are called neighborhoods, which are kind of groups of employees together in an area. So we believe it's going to enhance collaboration and teamwork. The design builds in very nice break rooms and lots of meeting spaces, for employees that need to go have private conversations. So this is going to be a bit of a cultural change as we implement this for our employees, but we've modeled it, as I said, on other successful organizations having done this in their areas. And we believe that a conservative estimate is that we could save the state over $125 million in 20 years in lease costs by shrinking our footprint. So purchasing, I won't get very much into this other than to say we purchase goods at an enterprise level for employees. Most purchasing and procurement is done at the department level, but we do have enterprise level agreements that we manage for things that we purchase, typically purchase in bulk. These are available not just to the state, but also to political subdivisions of the state. And you can see some of the examples of savings. IT services, we provide, and I'm getting close to the end here, we provide enterprise IT services for the state. This list identifies our six priorities. These were jointly set by our administrative services directors within departments. And then the last one is one that we've added. They are bandwidth, security, mobile device strategy and support, continuity of operations in the event of a disaster, identity management, and then we've added experience-based rate setting because right now our rate structure does not necessarily align with the experience of our customers. We want to make sure that our rate structure is rational, that it's fair, that it makes sense, and that it aligns agencies' costs with their usage and experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brief question for you, Commissioner. If you run back to purchasing, the previous slide, you're declaring savings of about $47 million in FY12. What is your baseline year you're comparison? You're saving over what baseline?
Through the Chair, President Sadler, that's a good question. And I'd have to go back and get an answer for you. I believe it's what we would have spent had we not had those contracts in place in that current fiscal year.
Okay.
But let me go back and confirm that for you. And finally, my last slide is insurance and injury, which is our Division of Risk Management. They have a very significant budget. They provide property insurance, and they also have responsibility for workers' compensation for the state in that area. As you can see, there's kind of an interesting dynamic going on here, which is often their expenses exceed their authorization. And that's because they have a fund called the Catastrophic Reserve Fund that they can dip into to pay claims when they are necessary. That fund is about $5 million, and you can see in FY12, we pretty much expended the bulk of that fund. So we'll be asking for additional authorization this year to collect risk management because we are getting to a point where because of workers' compensation costs and increasing property insurance costs, we're no longer able to. We've exhausted our reserve. So with that, I'll ask
Representative Barron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Commissioner, two questions. First is on this slide right here. In most organizations, state and private sector, slips and falls is the major reason for some of these health claims and injury. So do you consider the state's loss control getting that employee back in the job very aggressive or sort of aggressive or what?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, I think that's a very good question. I think we probably could be if we had, which would require resources obviously, more proactive in trying to prevent some workplace incidents. We've also identified the need for a return to work program. We don't have a return to work program. We do encourage employees, obviously, in departments to work with employees and getting employees back to work. But when an employee can't physically perform their job, the job they were in, we don't have an active program that just gets them back on the job. So I think it's an area that we're conscious of. We're looking at it within risk management. We primarily pay claims. And I think there's an opportunity there to become a bit more proactive.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, is that Alaska Public Entity and AMLGI have found is that they have hired staff that basically hold the employee's hand from the time they're injured until the time they get back, and it's because it saves a lot of money. The longer they're off, the more tendency they're going to stay even longer. And, Mr. Chairman, my second question is back to page 4. And so could you just two examples of what a spending growth reduction strategy is?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, one example I can give you that immediately comes to mind is within the Division of Retirement and Benefits, we're on the cusp of a huge influx of new retirees because baby boomers are retiring, starting to retire.
You're talking about me and the chairman, or what?
I was mentioning no names, but we do recognize that the volume is going to increase, and if we're going to continue to provide the same service, we're either going to have to do it with more people or we're going to have to do it with better processes. So the division has initiated a reorganization. They're using some operational excellence tools, Lean and Six Sigma, to identify all their processes, remove waste from their processes, because if you can remove waste, you can free up capacity. And they just told me today that they have one process where they've identified they can complete it in about 50% less time by eliminating those steps. So is that a cure-all for spending growth? Absolutely not. In this case, it's going to help us to meet a growing demand with the same resources, but hopefully as we continue this process in that division, we're not going to be asking for large numbers of PCNs to accommodate that volume.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Commissioner, you talked about the diminishment clause and the retirees' benefits for children of retirees under 26. And I thought you said that electing that as a state was not an option can you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, retirement plans are not covered essentially by the Affordable Care Act, which mandated that you cover dependents up to age 26. So our active plan is grandfathered under the Affordable Care Act, but is still subject to the Act. And so in the active plan, we now have extended coverage up to dependents up to age 26. In the retiree plan, it's not subject to the Act. I think, and I'm speculating here about intent, but that there was a desire because many employers are just dropping retiree coverage altogether. There was a desire not to add things into that plan that make those plans to make them more expensive, which would then result in employers dropping those plans. We can't obviously drop our plan because it's constitutionally protected, and we wouldn't contemplate that. But we don't have to add that coverage provision into the plan. There are retirees who don't understand. I moved from active status to retirement status, and my 25-year-old dependent was covered before, and now they're not. Why not? It's a very legitimate and logical question, but obviously adding that coverage in involves increasing costs, and that's what we're very hesitant to do.
And as a follow-up, what is it that the department believes covering retirees, youth, young adults would cost? Is it it's under $10 million? Is that
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't have that number. And at the top of my head, we can certainly get it for you and provide it to you.
Okay.
But again, we're very hesitant in an environment where we already have a $4 billion liability related to health to add to that.
Okay. And my last question, if I could. Does the department have a position, and I know this is a sort of an important question. Does the department have a position about a new defined benefit bill where all parties agreed the bill would not cost more than existing defined contribution plans? I guess what I'm saying is, if it doesn't cost the state anymore, are there other concerns, administrative headaches, those sorts of things?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think, and Mike Barnhill is our resident expert on pension issues, and perhaps can speak to this as well. The question is, what are you referring to when you say that a plan will not cost more? Because no plan starts with a built-in unfunded liability. But the risk exists in a defined benefit plan where the employer assumes the risk that an unfunded liability could develop. And so the answer is, if it shows initially that there's no unfunded liability, that the plan is self-sustaining, or the plan could theoretically cost less from an operational standpoint, that does not insulate the state from the development of a future unfunded liability.
Thank you.
And if I can weigh in on that, I think some of the people that are telling us that it's not going to cost us anything may have been the same people that got us into the mess we were in 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when we had to convert the plan. And it goes back to interest rates. It can go back to things as simple as using the wrong mortality table that assumed everybody was going to die off faster than what they did. There were a lot of ways plans can be, well, I hate to use the word manipulated, but they can be designed to appear to be one thing and might not necessarily deliver that. But I can tell you, as one of the people that was involved in the conversion, it was probably the toughest vote that I had, but I think we did the right thing when we did it, and I think the numbers are showing us that now, and we have something that we can budget for at least. We still have an unfunded liability that we're going to buy down in years that we have the money. We're also going to have, hopefully, money coming in from the stock market at various points in time, but we didn't have the, you know, what we did, other states have followed, but they have been much more draconian than what we did. They've made them, the plan, the one that comes to mind is Rhode Island, went into effect immediately because they were within 7 days of their plan being bankrupt. It applied to current members, retirees, everybody across the board. And they, the length of time before they could retire was adjusted. I mean, they made changes we we couldn't contemplate. Follow up or question?
Yes, and as the attorney said, within the scope, I'm not going to leave the subject. But I guess my last question, Commissioner, is there any, would the legislature in the department's view, if it has a view on this, be wise to simply take $11 billion out of the CBR, move it to PERS and TERS, and end the problem? Or should we do what is being proposed now and put $600 million in here and sort of amortize it over time?
Through the Chair, President Joseph, and I think Deputy Commissioner Barnhill will touch on some of those issues. However, I think there's a fundamental, there's a balancing act here between paying off a liability and ensuring that we have budget flexibility to meet all the other needs of the citizens of the state of Alaska, like schools, like roads, like public safety. And we are making the actuarially required contributions to manage our liability. So would the state be wise to do that? I think the concern I would express is if the price of oil goes to $40 next year, we may need some of those savings to help keep the lights on.
Representative Herron. Mr. Barnhill, you going to bail the boss out? Thanks, Commissioner Holtberg. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Olson, members of the committee. This is a presentation that we have historically done at the beginning of each session for Senate Finance. It's a high-level overview of the status of our public employee retirement system and teachers' retirement system. A lot of numbers in here. I'm happy to engage with you in discussion or questions along the way. We start out with the membership stats. Folks have been interested in primarily on this page what's going on with the composition of the active employee population, what percentage of that active employee population remains in the defined benefit plan and what percentage is now in the defined contribution plan. We were stuck at 75-25 for a bit, and now you can see.
Hey, Mike, could you state your name and affiliation for the record?
Sure.
I've been advised by the clerk that we were a bit remiss.
Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. As I was saying, we were stuck at a 75-25 split in the active population between defined benefit members and defined contribution members. This year, according to the draft FY12 actuarial evaluation, the defined contribution populations kicked up to about 31%. In the teacher system, we're still right there in the 75-73-27. We're starting to see those defined contribution active numbers go up. Over time, because in 2005, the legislature through SB 141, mm-hmm. closed the defined benefit plan to new employees beginning July 1st, 2006. Over time, we're going to see that the active plan is composed primarily of defined contribution numbers. New numbers for our balance sheet, according to the, and I, as I said, we have a draft valuation, and for the committee's benefit, normally what happens, you close the fiscal year, the actuaries start to work, they give us a draft valuation end of December, beginning of January. We have those numbers now. They've not been reviewed under SB 141 that was enacted in 2005. What is required is that a second actuary review those numbers before they are presented to the ARM board. That process has not begun, or if it has, it's just barely underway. The numbers will be reviewed by the second actuary and then presented to the ARM board in April of this year, and so the valuation won't become final until later this spring. Sometimes it goes into the summer or even the fall. But we can report at least these numbers for you now. Last year, you may recall that we used the figure $11.1 billion for the unfunded liability. According to these draft numbers, the unfunded liability has now grown to $11.9 billion. And that is primarily a function of investment returns. The investment returns for FY12 were approximately 0.5%. And one of the actuarial assumptions in these plans is that we will return 8% per year. So we missed that. Luckily, it wasn't a loss. We hate it when it's a loss. But we missed the actuarial return assumption by a fairly large margin. The funding ratio of the plans is correspondingly decreased. So for PERS, we're now at 61.3% funded. For TERS, 52.1% funded. Folks often ask me, well, what's a healthy plan? In a closed plan, like these plans are closed, an actuary will tell you a healthy plan is a plan that has 100% of its assets. Because you got to pay the rest of the liabilities, and you've at some point you're going to run out of cash. In an open plan, 80% is a healthy metric. We would love to see these figures closer to 80%, and we hope that the investment markets return and that we start earning closer to our actuarial rate of return assumption. But these are not particularly healthy numbers. There's a variety of reasons why the plans are unfunded, and I could go into them at length, but one of the reasons is growing health cost trends. And this is a page that's extracted from the valuations. It's page 4 every year. If you ever want to get onto the Division of Retirement Benefits website and turn to page 4, you can see what the premiums cost for retiree health coverage and how they have changed since 1977. And over the long term, if you look in the bottom right-hand corner, the annual change, compound change, is 9% per year, every year over that time period. Over the short term, delighted to report that healthcare costs have flattened out over the past couple of years, and we're seeing low single-digit growth. But if you look back, you can see this is actually consistent with a long-term pattern of rates climbing very sharply and then plateauing for a few years and then climbing sharply again. And so you can see that in the 2004 to 2008 time period and then sharp uptick in 2010 to 2011. And we spend a lot of time talking about healthcare at our office. And what we're trying to do is anything we can, the next time there's a sharp uptick, to see if we can flatten that out in some fashion. We would love to get the long-term annual cost growth rate something closer to the rate of inflation, or inflation plus 2 or 3%. You know, something in the 5% range would be fantastic for the plan. The actuaries have a health cost growth assumption that basically, what they're projecting for the next 30 to 40 years is health cost growth every year of around 6%. If we could beat that, that will help the actuarial status of the plan, and that in itself would help reduce the unfunded liability associated with health care. as the commissioner said, between PERS and TERS, the unfunded liability associated with health care is $4.1 billion. We expect that to stay about the same, even though the overall unfunded liability has increased. Most of that's a product of increases in the pension side, not the health side. This is also taken from the valuations, and this shows a history of the funded status of the public employee system. And you can see at 61%, we're about as low as we've ever been in the history of PERS. Again, a product most recently of poor investment returns. But quite frankly, the time period from the mid-1990s to 2002 where it shows an unfunded status is really a function of misreporting by the actuary at the time. The plans were never funded that high. There was underreporting and under-contribution, under-collecting from the employers, and we simply didn't collect enough in that time, and we're continuing to pay the price for that. Worst number, sadly, in the teacher system with...
Representative Josephson.
It occurs to me, Deputy Commissioner, if in the event that the Congress were to reform Medicare by extending the age to 67, that would sort of undermine your efforts, would it not? I mean, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here. That would be a bad thing for this program.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it would be, because you would expand that gap where there's no coverage between the normal retirement age, tier 1 normal retirement age 55, tier 3 normal retirement age 60. Already we have a gap between age 60 and the Medicare age of retirement where the plan is picking up the primary burden of the cost for those folks. And you can see that in the numbers. I mean, it's a pretty big cost. If we go to 67 and no change in the retirement plan, that coverage gap will expand further.
Now, for the new members, I'd like to add that the acts of our former actuary were so egregious that they settled out of court for $500 million rather than have it go to trial. They assume that the award would probably be higher if it went to trial, and all that money, I believe, was applied to the unfunded liability.
Yes, it was put into the health trust funds from PERS and TERS, and two of the actuaries were suspended from practice for 3 years by their governing organizations. So contribution rates, this tells the story that I just started. We had relatively low contribution rates in the early 2000s. That was primarily a product of underreporting, undercollecting, poor projections of what healthcare cost growth was at the time. We uncovered that in the FY02 valuation. At that time, an unfunded liability was disclosed of just over $4 billion. The boards at the time were struggling with how to deal with that unfunded liability and elected not to set the actuarial rate of contribution, the actuarial contribution rate, the ARC, to the full amount. Instead, they let that rate grow, and you can see that in that line between 2004 and 2006, 2007, 5% a year rather than go to the full rate. Instead, and what they did in so doing was capitalize the unfunded liability that they weren't recognizing in those rates. So we've got a climb, and then the legislature sunset those boards and replaced them with the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which has always set the rates at the full actuarial rate. And you can see that in 2007 where the rate spikes up in TERS to over 50% and grows a fair amount in PERS to over 30%. That created a problem for the legislature that it may not have been expecting, in that political subdivisions and school districts have to pay those rates. So when you get to having to contribute to a pension system amounts that are in excess of 50% of your payroll, that can tip a school district or a political subdivision into potential bankruptcy. So the legislature immediately acted. In the first year, in 2007, appropriated funds to buy down the rates, and then in 2008 passed a statute, SB 125, to cap the rate at 22% for political subdivisions and 12.56% for school districts. And that conferred a fairly generous amount of relief to political subdivisions and school districts within the state. And I must say that that sort of relief is, I think, fairly unusual in the United States. And more we're hearing about municipalities in other states that are actually filing for bankruptcy because they are unable to pay the mounting obligations from their public employment retirement systems. We've had a number of bankruptcies in California, including most recently San Bernardino, bankruptcies in Alabama, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and this, there are not a lot of them, but it's certainly more than we've experienced in years past. The markets returned in the 2007-2008 time period. The rates came down as a result of improved investment returns and actuarial experience. And then the markets crashed in 2009. The rates began to go back up. Pictured here are just the 2013 rates. We now have the 2014 rate and a draft proposed 2015 rate. There's a three-year rate setting lag. The valuation comes out for 2012. That will set the 2015 rates. The proposed rate for TERS for 2015 is over 60%. And the proposed rate for PERS for 2015 is about 40%. So these are, in both cases, the highest rates the system has ever seen.
Representative Josephson,
no.
Do you have a question?
No.
Thank you. No. So I introduced just a second ago state assistance that came on in 2008. And you can see what we've done historically. The state's contributed now just over $2 billion in state assistance to school districts and participants in PERS. Now, the lion's share of that goes to the state as employer. So it's about $1 billion each, $1 billion for school districts, $1 billion in PERS, of which, say, $600 million is on behalf of the state of Alaska as an employer. So we're looking at, you know, $1.4 plus billion in state assistance, which, you know, quite frankly, is extraordinary, and the system and the employers are grateful for your generosity. Looking forward, the governor has put into the FY14 budget request for, I believe, about $630 million. That's in the language section of the operating budget. But the On Board just recently made a methodology change, and folks that have been around this issue for a while are familiar with the terminology. For folks that haven't, I'll try to explain it. The unfunded liability can be likened to a debt that's amortized over time, a house mortgage. You borrow money from the bank, and it's amortized over a 30-year time period, and your payments every month or every year are exactly the same. That's a level dollar amortization. The On Board had not adopted the level dollar amortization. Instead, they had adopted previously a level percentage of pay amortization, which is more backloaded. And what that does is it means that your amortization, your annual payments will go up correspondent with growth in payroll, and their assumption for payroll is an increase of about 4% a year. So all things being equal, the unfunded liability would grow 4% a year. Another way of looking at it is the level dollar amortization is more front-loaded. You pay more sooner, and the level percentage of pay amortization is more back-loaded. You're going to pay more at the end when you account for inflation. This year, up until FY14, the amounts for state assistance were calculated on a level percentage of pay methodology, but the Army Board just recently adopted the level dollar amortization methodology. And in so doing, they're inviting the legislature to appropriate more funds for state assistance earlier rather than backloaded. So you can see that in this graph that the amounts jump sharply from 600 some million to close to a billion for FY15. They go up over a billion. And I should have prefaced this by saying these projections are based on the FY11 valuation. We do not have draft FY12 projections for state assistance yet. Hopefully we'll get them next week. I'm not expecting that they're going to improve this picture. But essentially what the Armed Board is inviting the legislature to do is to accelerate payments into the system in the form of state assistance, with payment amounts cresting over a billion in FY16 and then trending down until the unfunded liability is fully amortized. And they use a 25-year term for amortization. And we've been working on this since FY05. So roughly in 2030, we will fully amortize the initial unfunded liability that came up in the FY02 valuation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson?
Yes. If we back up one slide to page 23, you said that the legislature took action in 07-08 to ease the burden on political subdivisions,
right,
for these contributions. And it looks like we have to do this again, right? You said we're now going to climb over 50%.
Right. So the product of capping rates was that someone's got to pay. Well, if you're going to make the full mortgage payment, the full arc, to the system, someone's got to pay that. If the school districts and the employers don't pay it, then the state has to pay it. And that's what's shown here. These are the amounts that the state paid, and they represent the difference in the actual rate between the 22% and the real rate, the actuarial rate for the public employee system, and 12.5% and the real rate, the actuarial rate for the teacher system.
And could you remind me, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, why is the maximum rate for PERS 22 and teachers 12 plus?
What was the theory? Well, that was a product of smoke-filled room negotiation, I think. The 22%, literally, that was just a negotiated figure. The municipalities were here.
As I recall, I think it was a number that we felt would keep smaller cities and school districts from going belly up, and we were real close to losing a few of them.
Yeah, the 12.5.
It was an arbitrary number, but it apparently worked. We haven't lost anybody yet.
Yes, Mr. Chair. With respect to PERS, it was an arbitrary negotiated number. With respect to TERS, however, that was the actuarial projection for normal cost for the system in the valuation that was before the legislature at the time. And maybe I should back up and talk about the different components of cost. So normal cost is what the normal cost rate is, what an employer will contribute to the system if all of the actuarial assumptions are perfectly accurate. So assumptions regarding how much you're going to earn in the markets, assumptions of when people are going to die, assumptions of when people are going to retire, assumptions about how much healthcare is going to cost. If all of those actuarial assumptions are correct, then that's all you have to contribute is the normal cost. Well, we know they're never correct, so there's always some adjustment. Any adjustment falls into what we call past service cost rates. So 12.5% was the normal cost rate for the teacher system at the time. And the judgment call, the policy call that the legislature made is that the state will pick up the entire past service cost for school districts and share it with the political subdivisions. Okay, so this is the vision of the future that the Armed Board would like to convey to the legislature and what they would like the legislature to appropriate over the next 20 or so years. This is the path we were on until the Armed Board made its adjustment to its amortization methodology. We were on the level percentage of pay, and you can see the bars trend up over time, consistent with a more backloaded amortization. But in the short term, they're closer in amount to what we have historically paid. So we put these slides out here for your consideration. Again, the onboard has invited the legislature to appropriate according to this slide. It's our view that the legislature, despite what the onboard recommends, still retains the power of appropriation. And there are a variety of ways of paying off this debt, including, I mean, ranging from Representative Josephson's throw all the money that we have in the bank into the plan to some financing or amortization of the debt in a variety of ways. Luckily for you, I didn't bring my spreadsheet. Last year with the onboard, we went through dozens of scenarios of how we could manage this debt, and it was a spreadsheet that looked like this with just dozens of different ways of doing it. You don't need to go through dozens of scenarios. The basic thing you need to know, and it's reflected in these two slides, with any debt, the more you pay off now, the less you have to pay in the long run. And that's reflected here. Under level percentage of pay, we will pay more in the long run. However, we may have the ability under level percentage of pay to manage short-term obligations easier than we would otherwise. That's a judgment call and a call for ultimately for the legislature and the governor to make. This slide reflects our projected growth in retirement population. We're right around 40,000 retirees between the two systems right now. We expect to close in on something close to 60,000 by the end of the decade. No big surprise, it's the baby boom generation that's retiring. This will put pressure in two primary places. One, on the Division of Retirement Benefits to process and admit process applications for retirement and administer a larger retiree population. It will also put some pressure.
We're living longer.
What's that?
We're living longer.
I hope all of the retirees live really long. It also, I think, puts some pressure, additional pressure on cash flow, because there'll be more folks that will be getting benefit payments every month, and there will be more folks that will be submitting health care claims. With additional demands on cash flow, that potentially impacts rates of return and asset allocation.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do the survivor benefits that people elect, are they covering what your division needs in order to make those payments? In other words, where the retiree predeceases a spouse, right?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I quite understand the question. So there are survivor benefits, but the money just flows out. That money isn't, there isn't anything that's held back to help administer the system.
Except if I may, they pay a premium for selecting the SVP, right?
Yes, but that premium I don't believe is held back. I think probably ought to ask the Division of Retirement Benefits and just get back to you on exactly how that cash flow works. This we've become accustomed to talk about the unfunded liability in terms of its one way of looking at it, its net present value, $11 billion. It's $12 billion. That number can go up and down based on, you know, what assumption you use. If you use a higher earnings assumption like 8.5, then the unfunded liability would decrease to something less than $10 billion. If you use a lower earnings assumption like 5%, some economists are recommending the unfunded liability would go up to over $20 billion. What I like to do is direct folks' attention to what we expect to have to pay out in nominal dollars over the remaining years of the system. These are the hard liabilities that the system has to meet. We have to make these payments per the Constitution. These folks have earned these benefits. They must be paid. And so we've begun asking the actuary to just give us the full projection. This is a closed system. Most of the folks will have passed away by 2080. Show us what the demands for cash on the system will be between now and 2080. And so you can see here that we're presently, our cash flow out the door is close to $1.5 billion. It's going to go up over $3.5 billion by 2040 something or other, and then it grades down. The important thing that I think is to take away from the slide is not so much the number, $140 billion, it's a huge number, but it's over a 70-year time period. It's that the demands on the system are going to be over $3 billion a year for 20 years. And the concern I have with defined benefit systems, and we've experienced this over the last 20 years, is that unfunded liabilities can crop up at any time. We miss an 8% return assumption for a couple of years. You've got an unfunded liability. Obviously, we hope that we earn 8% for the next 60 years. Do I think that's reasonably likely? I have no idea. If I look back over the past 60 years, you can see that, you know, business cycles come and go. And there are years when we earn 30% in the markets, and there are years when we lose 30% in the markets. My concern for the state of Alaska is this 20-year period when the system is going to need to pump out $3 billion bucks a year. And what are we going to do if we have another unfunded liability, if we have another shortfall in returns? And I just think that's something we just need to continue to bear in mind as we're thinking about new ways of addressing public employment, retirement, whether we go back to a defined benefit plan and the risks that might pose, and how we manage our cash in this state.
Any questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, I don't know if I could drag you in a discussion about the merits of particular legislation, but there are some efforts in the building to pass a bill that would give us a combination hybrid deferred benefit, deferred compensation. Do you want to step out into that debate at all and offer an opinion?
So through the chair, Representative Sadler, if you're talking about SB 30, which was introduced in the Senate this week, SB 30 is substantively identical to SB 121, which passed the Senate last year. And the administration opposed it last year, and the administration continues to oppose any what I would call pure defined benefit plan. In other states, there's been a fair amount of experimentation with alternatives to defined benefit. They call them hybrids, DB-DC hybrids. And we are willing to entertain that discussion so long as we protect the state of Alaska against the sort of unfunded liability that has arisen under the current plans. If there are other ways of securing retirement for employees, that's a discussion we're willing to have. Okay. I've said this in the past, but in this session I'll say it again. We believe in secure retirement as much as the folks that are proposing these bills. Mm-hmm. Our concern with defined benefit is we don't think that it provides a secure retirement. Our concern is what has happened in other states. We do not want that to happen here. In other states, they have cut benefits to existing retirees. That's happened in Colorado. It's happened in Rhode Island. It's happened in South Dakota. It's happened in Minnesota, I believe.
Not only retirees, current employees.
And current employees. And we think that's unfair. And we don't want to set the state of Alaska up to have the same thing happen where it's easy to make a promise, it's harder to deliver on that promise. It's easier for folks to say, oh, we're going to return 8% for the next 60 years, no problem. It's easy to say that, but the folks in the building 30 years from now are going to have to deliver on that. And if they're anything like the folks in the legislatures of Colorado and South Dakota and New Jersey and New York and Rhode Island, they might be thinking, well, I don't think it's fair to shut the library so that this retiree can get their full pension. I don't think it's fair to cut the teachers, and we don't want that to happen.
And just to kind of ask a question, expand on that, what is the trend nationally? What are other states doing? Has Alaska been a leader or been a follower or in making this transition from defined benefit to defined contribution?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, unquestionably Alaska has been a leader. It's one of, I think, two states that have closed its defined benefit plan. Most other states have been experimenting with some hybrid or keeping their plans open. But I think some credit has to be given to Governor Murkowski, quite frankly, for having the vision and foresight to see that this was a problem that needed to be taken care of, immediately.
Can you say that one more time louder?
I said it once.
No. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Well, I guess my first comment is the use of the word leader, and I understand that I'm certainly alarmed by what I see. But my question through the chair is about the health care portion. If this document is accurate, and I would think that it would be, as your commissioner testified, the problem is the health care, and I see that on the chart where it was $500 premiums 12 years ago, and now it's $1,300. If a proposal was made that did not cover retirees' health care, would that not be a starting point to then make a defined benefit under a Tier 5 more solvent and more conceivable?
Through the chair, if the proposal is a pure DB pension plan, then the administration most likely is going to oppose that. I mean, the problem in this case is health care costs, but it's not just health care costs, it's investment returns. So, you know, when you're looking at stagnant investment returns over a prolonged period of time, and if the employer is responsible for making the system whole, you're going to have an unfunded liability. I really think the answer is in looking beyond pure DB to more equitable risk sharing and some of these other creative alternatives that other states have adopted. And I should say, you know, when I say Alaska's been a leader, I'm proud of what we've done, quite frankly, because other states have cut benefits. We have not cut benefits. We've not been unfair. We have changed the deal to a new generation of employees. We haven't started a generation of employees and then changed the deal. And I think that's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
We should still have 2W pass. Are you still with us, 2W?
Representative Olson, this is TW Patch. I am still with you. Thank you very much, sir.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thanks for staying on.
You're more than welcome for my staying on. You summoned me. I'm happy to be there.
Could you identify yourself for the record and give us about a 30-minute update on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska?
I'd be happy to, sir. Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to present to you and your committee on the activities of the RCA. My name is T.W. Patch, and I have the distinct privilege of serving the commission as a commissioner. It is a job which I believe affords me an intellectual diet that is widely varied, and thankfully it's non-fattening. Along with my fellow commissioners, I monitor the hopes and needs of Alaska's citizens, and I concern myself with most aspects of utility service. I am aware that some aspect of utility service likely touches every Alaskan every day, each day of the year. And everyone at the RCA works hard to assure you and their neighbors that safe, reliable, reasonably continuous, just and reasonably priced utility service is available. That is what we do, and by doing that, we are rewarded. By way of thanks to the earlier speakers, I'd like to commend Commissioner Holtberg, What she observed was, we may need cash to keep the lights on. I will tell you that is a concern that we attend to every day, keeping the lights on. I would ask that to the extent that many of you have questions as I present today, questions which may stem for your awareness of larger policy issues presently before other committees, concerns of your neighbors about their individual utility bills, concerns about the agency and its process, I certainly invite you to pose your questions as they occur to you. The kind of dialogue that can go on between us if I respond to your questions shapes, I believe, better your information and may well make my presentation somewhat more entertaining. I was asked by Mr. Jackson to make a presentation in the nature of a 40,000-foot high-speed pass, and that is what I propose to do. I believe that your committee has already been delivered a copy of the department overview, that is the DCCED, Governor's Operating Budget Overview, and I'm confident that each of you has already received the Regulatory Commission of Alaska Fiscal Year 2012 Annual Report. So it is not my intention to offer quite the same kind of statistical or financial detail of the reports you've heard earlier today. I would also add to Mr. Josephson, who is new to the committee and new to me, that I look forward to meeting you face-to-face on some trip to Juneau, sir. And I am always available to you and Representative Olson, you may assure all your members that I am available to them at any point in time.
I'd like that. He is extremely responsive.
Yeah. Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're more than welcome, sir. I'd like to tell you a story in a little bit different fashion. I intended to be in your hearing room today. The combination of a broken engine on an Alaska Airlines jet and the pilot's warning that he really didn't think that he could land in Juneau since Juneau had been below minimums for about 6 or 7 hours before he loaded us on the airplane led me to opt to return to my office. Upon returning to my office, to my home. I left my home this morning and found my way to my office. My day began with a call to the Rural Utility Service. I arranged to take some meetings with them about the NACNEC electric bankruptcy while I'm in D.C. next week. I will be there attending a National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners conference. I have a number of other items of business to attend to, and I'll touch on some of those. But they are services that I believe the RCA benefits from, by benefiting from, in turn provides benefits to the utilities we serve. After I dealt with the NACNEC electric bankruptcy matter, I was transferred at my request to the commissioner's office at the Rural Utility Service, and I arranged to meet with Jessica Zufalo while I'm there and ask for additional grant funding for the build-out of telephone utility service in rural Alaska. I next moved to a call where I spoke with members of the federal, the FERC staff. I discussed meetings with them about their recent decision allowing Hawaii to import liquefied natural gas with no jurisdictional element of the FERC engaged in oversight. As you are undoubtedly aware, LNG is a topic of great discussion in Alaska today, and if we can camp on to the benefits that are presently being afforded Hawaii, that will be of some benefit to the state of Alaska. I next moved to an editing responsibility. I concluded with the editing and submittal to the governor's office a letter requested by the governor regarding RCA input on a matter of concern. I next dealt with a telephone call from the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners President Jones about our upcoming conference. I accepted an appointment that he wished to make, putting my name before the membership of the National Regulatory Research Institute. And in conversation with President Jones, I procured the appointment of Commissioner Bob Pickett to the NARUC Gas Subcommittee on LNG Exports. Approximately 8 o'clock this morning, I spoke with Mr. Jackson, informed him that I was not in Juneau, and we made the arrangements to meet in this fashion today. I moved on to a staff meeting to plan for my absence next week and to direct research on dockets. I began then to prepare for a hearing. Hearing took place this morning involving Chugach Electric Association, PhilCorp, Golden Valley Electric Association, NSTAR, Matanuska Electric Association, and the Attorney General. It was a complex hearing. It is not finally resolved, but it is on a positive track, I believe. It will afford, if you believe the pleadings, Chugach Electric Association some relief on its margins, and it will afford the membership of Golden Valley some saving to its members. When that hearing was over, I spent some time reviewing and editing orders, notices, and letter orders that need to be released between today and the time I leave for Mother Nehru conference. I enjoyed a telephone conference with the executive director of the Alaska Telephone Association about his winter conference and my invitation to him regarding attending a conference with Federal Communications Commissioner Pai next week. I've attended this meeting with you, and whatever else needs to be done will be done after we conclude the business. And I think the last thing I'll probably do today is pack a briefcase with 400 or 500 pages of weekend reading. In that regard, my job is not unlike that of a legislator. I know you will spend a great portion of your time studying and reading as well. I propose now to do what we did last year, to turn to some numbers. Numbers can represent dollars. Dollars are often paid as rates. Rates for service translate to utility company billings. So numbers, in some respect, are as good a place to start as any. And I've selected a few numbers that impact the RCA in a rather random fashion. I would like to inform you that I have asked the legislative budget and audit people who will join with us in our work environment probably next week to give me an 8-year, not me personally, but the commission, an 8-year extension. The RCA last underwent a sunset review in 2011. LBNA recommended an 8-year extension at that time. I will hope they will make that same recommendation this time. The legislature, in its waning days in 2011, opted to give the RCA a 3-year extension, so our review will be presented to you in 2014. At present, we are down to 4 commissioners. Commissioner Kate Guyard, after serving for approximately 10 years, resigned from state service on January 4th, and there are 4 commissioners presently serving the people of the state of Alaska. The governor does have certain names under consideration. I believe he will make an appointment, hopefully soon. Another number that gets bandied about frequently in the state of Alaska is $500 million. That's the sum of money that the legislature authorized to be spent in the AGEA and Trans-Canada process. That is a lot of money for one family if you're going to spend it on vacation. It would make for an extravagant Christmas present. But I'd like to put it into a utility perspective. I'd like to inform you that one South Central Electric utility has indicated it will spend $460 million. That's just $40 million shy of the $500 million being spent for TransCanada. And it will spend that $460 million over the next 4 years for necessary distribution system improvements and other capital projects related to reliable service. That South Central utility does not have 700,000 ratepayers, as the state does, as it may apportion that $500 million to each citizen. In the same ballpark, there are two utilities, again, in the South Central area, who've informed us that they intend to spend $263 million for one, $300 million for the other, a combined total of $563 million for electric services. They will spend this to have available adequate generation to meet their anticipated needs. Again, those two utilities don't have a $700,000 member service base. They have significantly smaller ratepayer numbers. And now the number one, and I would like to thank my engineering staff for this. If you have ever wondered, when you read your electric utility bill, if you ever wondered what a kilowatt was or what it looked like, well, here we go. If you walked into a room and toggled that ubiquitous white plastic, you would be generating, spending, lighting up kilowatts. If you had 17 60-watt light bulbs, the energy that would be consumed when you flip that toggle would be 1 kilowatt. And if you left the room and left the lights on for one continuous hour, that would be what you see on your bill, 1 kilowatt hour. And now you have a measure. Next year, I hope to be able to come back to you and explain what a billion is. A billion in the context of 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas. What it looks like, how big it is, what space it takes up, how many billion cubic feet might fit within the Anchorage Sports Dome or underneath the cap of Mount Finley. I'll see if I can come up with a visual. The two of you remaining in the room are quite aware of what our process is. And I would at this juncture, Representative Olson, if you would wish, truncate my proceeding for my speeches so that you and Representative Sadler may move on to other matters.
You stuck on the line to join us. You've got till 5 o'clock.
Well, one of the things we talked about last year, I will truncate my proceeding and I won't go through the process that we employ. But I will identify for you some significant issues. We have arranged to host a cyber security conference. We will be doing that this summer. There will be a presentation to the Alaska Telephone Association. There will likely be a presentation statewide for the benefit of our electric utilities. Cybersecurity is an issue that concerns utilities across the world. There are utilities in this state that have demonstrated, to my satisfaction, that they have been attacked.
and I am concerned about cybersecurity. The commission will be studying that matter. One of the accomplishments we have made this year, I think it is a significant accomplishment, has to do with credit ratings. As you are most likely aware, the state obtained a very favorable rating from Fitch, the National Rating Service. I think both the legislature and the governor have every right to be proud of that accomplishment. As an agency, we have been informed by a number of our larger utilities that they too are receiving positive ratings from their rating agencies as those utilities go out to borrow capital. Some of those ratings remain confidential within the utilities, but one of the reported items that I take pride in is when a utility president calls me and says that a rating agency believes the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is a positive influence on a company's credit picture. Perhaps I'm being overly proud, but I think that's well for this agency. I continue to be concerned about rural infrastructure, whether it's as direct as the cost of fuel oil in rural Alaska or the feasibility of replacement of aged generation. But those are matters that this agency has begun to work extremely hard with, both on the bulk fuel loan program and with APA. You may be aware that Representative Edgman has introduced House Bill 39, amending the PCE program. We've reviewed that bill. We've provided an analysis, and we've indicated we don't believe there's any fiscal impact for this agency in that bill. We are in the process of also addressing PCE. We have a plan to send our staff out into rural Alaska to train them on site in terms of what they must do to get reinstated in the PCE program. We hope to be able to accomplish that with grant funding. We hope to get it accomplished by mid-year. We will report to you on that as the program unfolds. I'm concerned about LNG, whether it's the plants that are now being considered by DNR on the North Slope. There are three or four competing plans. I'm concerned about the LNG import issue as it's being debated, but concern does not relate to fear or it just relates to better planning. I'm concerned about storm issues. You've undoubtedly been made aware of the large windstorm in Joplin, Missouri, some few years ago. You're undoubtedly aware of the tidal wave that swept over Fukushima, and you're undoubtedly aware of the gas line explosion in San Bruno. We have begun looking at hardening and making more reliable our electric utility systems. Some of those issues were brought before us this past September, when certain rainstorms had people's power out for a period of time. The utility companies are all being very cooperative, very helpful, and very forthcoming. I hope we can do something about that, but it is a concern. We have begun an outreach program with other state agencies. We work very closely with DNR and the Joint Pipeline Safety Office. We work very closely with DEC and AOGCC on matters such as fracking and resources. As I mentioned earlier, we work very closely with the Alaska Power Authority on PCE matters. those are some of my concerns. Representative Olson, if I may, I'll simply stop here.
Well, I've got one question. TAPS balancing, is that just about done?
TAPS is not done. Today was the day when we received some the reply briefs from the parties. There are 11 parties. Carriers were allowed 200 pages for their reply briefs, and the other parties were allowed 150 pages for their reply briefing.
So that's part of the reading you're going to be doing tonight?
I doubt that that will be what I do tonight. It will be what I take on an airplane. My estimate of the final post-hearing briefs and reply briefs indicates to me that I have about 4,000 pages of briefing to read. In connection with the 11 parties and the 4,000 pages of briefing and reply briefing, I can tell you that the Commission has enjoyed approximately 20 weeks of active hearing preparation and in-hearing room time. We've traveled back and forth to Washington, D.C., and the parties have traveled to Alaska on a number of occasions. There are document sets, evidence, independent of briefing, that amount to about 3,000 multi-page exhibits exceeding 15 pages in length. There are over 600 filing entries into 12 dockets spanning the period of 4 years from 2008 until 2012. There are over 12,000 pages of transcript taken during the hearings. We have approximately $1 billion of money at issue. That's an estimate, because the carriers have not sought to deal with pump station one issues yet. It is a big case. When I am in Washington, I will be discussing the case somewhat with the chief judge for FERC.
You know, if you could send us a summary of that particular portion, I can give it not only to our committee, but to the LBNA committee as well.
I'd be happy to do that, sir. I'll get that to you first part of the week.
Excellent. Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Patch, I do have a question for you. You said that you are looking for and hope to quickly have a replacement commissioner to help you deal with your workload. Sir, I'd offer the question, is there any other resources or assets you need to meet the demands of the workload before the commission?
To be honest, Representative Sadler, yes. The legislature was most generous a year ago, as was the administration. We were afforded the opportunity to bring on an additional engineering analyst and an additional financial analyst. It had been I had envisioned using those positions, or using that capacity, not those positions, but using that capacity predominantly for planning purposes. It's important that everyone who works here know and understand what we do. The certification process, the tariff analysis process, the rate case process, but also the emerging issues and best practices process. We need to think forward. But while those positions were authorized, we have encountered a little bit of difficulty finding getting space so I can hire those people, put them in a place where they can learn and be productive. It had been my hope that had I been in Juneau today, I could have discussed my space concerns with Commissioner Hultberg. I don't find her to be resistant. I just need to bring the matter directly to her. I'm well aware of the governor's desire to hold down the budget, to be very, very careful about expanding the budget especially in a time of oil price uncertainty. But I would advance the argument that in many respects, the RCA, while it has an authorized budget provided by the legislature, funds itself from monies paid by ratepayers, and therefore is not a drain on, not otherwise a drain on state resources.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had additional space, if I were authorized to procure additional space, it would make my hiring people, placing them, employing them, better, I believe, in terms of service delivery, both to utilities, shared workload amongst the existing staff, and capacity for forward thinking.
I trust that message will reach the commissioner's attention.
The first time I have an opportunity to meet with Commissioner Hultberg or others whose time is at a premium, your colleagues, people you see every day on the streets of Juneau, I will advocate strongly for the agency that affords me a daily living and great satisfaction when the job is done well.
I think we can help you on the sunset extension. I think you complied with everything that was asked of you the last time this came up, and certainly 8 years is not unreasonable to me. And I know what kind of a gun it put you guys under.
Well, I tell you that after having presented to the legislature last year a plan where we did not ask for any relief on the timeline issues, we didn't ask for any special legislation. We simply took it upon ourselves to tighten the belt of time around our waists and work harder and more efficiently. We have not missed a single shortened deadline. We have kept our promise to you. We have been efficient in the use and employment of our resources, and I believe that the utilities are appreciative of our effort, and I think it's been a positive motivation for us to achieve those targets, and I think it's been beneficial and well-received throughout the business community that we service.
Well, give us a call when you're coming down, and we'll block off some time.
I'd very much welcome that opportunity, sir. Thank you very much for the very kind invitation, and I wish those of you still in the hearing room, all of you.
Well, some of them that bailed out on us were experiencing the same kind of flight problems you were, and they were trying to get out of here on earlier flights. But I think you'll see a full committee next time.
All that when I am in Juneau, I'd be happy to meet with them. If any of them have a desire to learn how to handle a rate case, I can arrange that instruction.
Excellent. Thanks again. And with that, we will adjourn at 5 p.m.